Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you do if you got word 40 years after he'd been given up for dead that your brother, husband, or father might still be alive? After U.S. Army Private McKinley Nolan left his Texas home and family in 1966 to serve in Vietnam, they never laid eyes on him again. The Army later concluded Nolan had defected to the Viet Cong, and returning POWs reported having seen him often, along with his Cambodian wife and child. But his American wife, son, and brother never gave up hoping for his return and were electrified by what they were told by a former U.S. soldier who believes he may have seen Nolan alive in Vietnam as recently as 2005.
And I see this black guy standing on the roadway. And he's not looking me in the eye. Asked him where he was from. He said, Texas. I said, whereabouts? It was a mumble, but I could have sworn he said Washington.
I would assume he stuttered.
I started to ask him another question or make a comment. And this man literally just walked away from me down the street. This little Vietnamese man comes running across the street, pointing at this guy, and he say, "He VC, he VC, the American VC." I hurried down the street, and when I round the corner, he's gone.
Filmmaker Henry Cora tells the story in his new documentary, The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan. It's screening this week as part of the Dallas International Film Festival. Henry, welcome to Think.
Hey, how are you, Chris? I'm really honored to be on.
Well, I'm glad to have you. This is a film that poses so many more questions than ultimately it's able to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you were prepared for when you first got involved with the project?
Well, pretty much, you know, I've been making nonfiction films, telling very, you know, intensely personal stories for like over 25 years now. And I've learned, sort of, I've stumbled into the learning, into the understanding of not knowing and approaching films without too many preconceived ideas of how they're going to turn out. So basically what attracted me to the McKinley Nolan story was when journalist Richard Lynette, who had been following the story for 10 years, a friend of mine in New York, mentioned to me that this Vietnam vet had sighted a guy who was had been missing for 40 years. I asked if, and that he was going to Texas to meet the family. I said, well, you know, you think I could be there and just see what happens and see if there's a film in it? I got on the plane, went to Texas, was with Dan Smith when he first met the Nolan family, and it's like with every other movie that I've made, a bell went off, and I said, these people, this story is going to be amazing. I have no idea how it's going to turn out, but I want to take this journey with these people.
And Dan Smith is that former Army lieutenant that we heard at the top of the show saying, I spotted this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about his initial reaction to seeing someone that he thought must be a defector.
Right. At first, Dan was sort of like, how could this guy have betrayed our country? He was angry. He wanted to report him as and have justice served upon him. But then after he met the family and he looked into their eyes and saw this sort of the 40 years of not knowing that he could see on this beautiful family's face, Mary Nolan, McKinley's wife, Roger Nolan, McKinley's son, who was only 2 years old when McKinley left for Vietnam in 66, and his brother, his younger brother, when he met them and heard their story and saw the sort of longing in their eyes, he completely did a turnaround and decided he wanted to help them. And in a way, I think for Dan, it was a kind of way that he could make try to find peace around his post-traumatic experience that had been going on for 40 years as well.
Yeah, and part of the reason he returned to Vietnam in the first place, and we'll listen to this now, is trying to sort of process his own emotions about the war.
Exactly.
When I killed... I killed my first man, or boy, like me, we were boy, and that pretty much ruined my life. Once you kill someone, once you take a life, I truly believe you forfeit your own as well. And so, anyway, yeah, Vietnam was...
You know, it's so interesting, Henry, when we hear him correct himself and say, it was a boy I killed and I was a boy, you sort of understand right in that moment how his thoughts have shifted and how he understands now that, that everyone involved, to a certain extent, was a victim of this thing that was much bigger than they could ever have been.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's amazing to me is that that scene that you just played happened within the first 30 minutes of me filming. And I would say the first 20 minutes of the entire movie happened in that first 2 days of shooting. And that's so rare. I mean, the way that we make movies is almost the opposite of what you do. You know, you have a show where you bring a guest on like myself, and you've never met me before. And you go live with me.
Right, right. We dive right in and hope it turns out okay.
Which I think is really beautiful, and actually you're taking... You know, you're a risk taker and you're an improviser, obviously. So it's, you know, I mean, there is a, I want to do a comparison between what you do and what we do, because I think it's telling. For us, it's like it's becoming emotionally embedded over years. In the case of the McKinley Nolan film, 3 years, and becoming very subjective. And, you know, when I first met the Nolan family and I asked Mary Nolan, first there was that scene with Dan that you just heard. It was sort of in a diner on the way to the Nolan's house. And then when we arrived, I looked into Mary Nolan's eyes. She's a beautiful, gracious woman. And this very simple, she runs a juke joint in Washington, Brazos, Texas. Just beautiful person, beautiful countryside, beautiful cadence to her voice, and a very graceful person. And I said, Mary, you know, what's it like? You've never remarried. What's it like to, you know, to be married to a man that you haven't heard from in 40 years? And she just looked up at me and said, till death do us part. And I was like completely blown away. I just, you know, and that is in the beginning of the film. And I know I'm not being articulate right now, but I deliberately so, because I had no idea where the film was going to go or why, but it was because of the way she looked at me and because of the way Dan had that moment that you so astutely played just now. It was those two moments in that day that made me know that there was an incredible journey ahead and an incredible film to be made. And that's all I had to go on at first.
Were you surprised at how quickly they trusted you with those very deep emotions?
I'm always honored, you know, and amazed at how people will share. You know, it's an extraordinary proposition that I bring. Is I come into people's lives and I say, "Hi, I'm Henry Cora. Can I be with you while you live your life for the next few years?" And I always, you know, wonder, you know, I always think about how, you know, what must be like for them. But I'm honored, because usually, I mean, in fact, always, it ends up being a mutually beneficial experience. In other words, I'm not trying, you know, that day, the day that Dan came and spoke and told the Nolans about the sighting, it wasn't just Dan and the Nolans that made a pact, but it was like the three of us, Dan, the Nolans, and the filmmakers, made a pact to take the journey together.
So
I was honored, and also very quickly became much more than a filmmaker. I became an advocate and kind of a brother to Dan and Michael.
What are the last official whereabouts of McKinley Nolan's Army service?
His last official, the last official document, I believe, was a memo from Kissinger in 73 after Operation Homecoming, from Kissinger's office with a photo of the house that McKinley Nolan was living in and working on a coffee plantation in the Chamkar Cafe, which is a in the Mae-Mot region of Cambodia, just over the border from Thay Ninh, Vietnam, mm-hmm. which is where Dan sighted him 40 years later. He was last... there was a memo from Kissinger's office that acknowledged that he was there, and they were debating whether or not they should lift him out. And it sort of the documentation sort of trails off there, or is classified in knowing what why they did not decide to airlift him out with the rest of the people in Operation Homecoming.
And am I correct that some of those documents would be made public if Mary Nolan were to decide to go ahead and declare, have her husband declared dead?
It's a beautiful and tragic dilemma. Mary Nolan, I don't want to give away too much of the film, not that it's a spoiler-type movie. It's a film about mourning, it's a film about loss, and it's a film about the long-term effects of war.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is a mystery.
Yeah.
And one of the ultimate dilemma of Mary right now is that she's got an enormous amount of evidence. As she says, 99.9% sure that her husband was, in fact, murdered. But there's that one-tenth of 1% that is preventing her from both truly mourning his loss and also preventing her from having him declared dead, which in effect would release would allow the government to release the classified documents, so that she and the family could actually find out what happened.
Now, the Army assumed at least that he did something called going native, which is essentially meaning that he decides to sort of take up relationships and sympathies with the local population. Is that right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. How common was that during the Vietnam War?
It happened. There are a number of cases, but with McKinley, the thing that's interesting about McKinley is that there are so many different stories, and everything is the thing that was challenging and interesting about having McKinley Nolan as the central character of our film is that he was a ghost that nobody really knew anything about. Nobody really knew anything. It was all speculation. You know, some say he went native, some say he fell in love, some say he was involved with Operation Phoenix and the drug trade that was going on in Saigon and Thailand at the time. Some say that he possibly murdered two South Vietnamese guards and escaped from Long Binh prison. And he basically just sort of had to defect. But that evidence doesn't really hold up because why would Kissinger 6 years later be debating whether they wanted to lift him out or not if he were actually had murdered or fragged, as the word that they used at the time, two guards. So, you know, McKinley becomes a character that everybody in the movie projects, everybody in the movie and everybody in life projects what they want onto.
Filmmaker Henry Cora is my guest. His documentary, The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan, screens this week at the Dallas International Film Festival. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Henry Cora. His new documentary, The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan, is screening this week as part of the Dallas International Film Festival. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Henry, what can we say definitively, if anything can be said definitively, about the kinds of relationships that McKinley Nolan formed while he was in Vietnam and then Cambodia?
Well, we know for sure that that in Cambodia, in the years 1973 to 1977, that he made some very close friendships as the Khmer Rouge was sort of growing and rearing its ugly head. And he became more and more of a prisoner. We believe that he and his wife, his Vietnamese Cambodian wife, went across the. Again, nothing definitive here. You said the word definitive. Nothing is definitive with McKinley Nolan, but we believe that in 73 they went across the border into Cambodia to escape the war in Vietnam. Now, having no idea what they were getting into. So they ended up at the Cham Car Cafe, the coffee plantation at the Mae Mot region. And at first, he lived very peacefully. And we met a number of people who appear in the film, like Cham Son, who were very close friends of him. They called him Buller. They considered him a big man who, as things became more violent with the Khmer Rouge, he was known for protecting people, for standing in front of people who were being beaten and taking the beatings for them. We heard stories of his sense of humor and his goodness, and they would make fun of his the difficulty he had speaking Khmer. And he was loved. He was loved. But at the same time, there's also, again, this film never has a simple answer. This story never has a simple answer or a simple idea of who you should be rooting for, because Cham Son, who probably was one of his closest friends, was also became a Khmer Rouge guard at the coffee plantation where McKinley was allegedly murdered. He was allegedly beaten to death by six guards with shovels and buried in a shallow grave. And then they killed his wife later and ate his dog, allegedly.
The city we're in now is 1 million young people here, no old people. These people killed their own people. You hear me? I am telling you the truth. This happened in 79 and 80. This ain't, you know what I'm saying? So, and he was right in the middle of it.
And that was Michael Nolan that we just heard?
Yes.
In the film? You know, what's really remarkable about those scenes is the sort of surprising lack of ire from the people who loved McKinley Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
They were more sort of taken by the fact that they were comforted by the fact that their son, their brother, their husband had been loved.
Yes. Well, I mean, I had no idea, but basically the journey, on the journey to Vietnam, Dan and Michael encountered Quang. Son, who in essence was McKinley Nolan's stepson, adopted son. He's now a man in his 40s. He joined them on the journey, and so he was he's a former Viet Cong. He joined them on the journey, and they ended up in Cambodia together with this Khmer Rouge guard, who in effect was giving a thinly veiled confession of perhaps being complicit in McKinley's murder. And the four of them, Dan Smith, Michael Nolan, Cham Son, and Quang, are all basically in tears comforting each other. All the former enemies have come together and are basically devastated by 40 years later. Yet they were the only ones who could comfort each other. ultimately.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Thomas in Louisville. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment on this the show that you're doing now. First of all, it's a great show, but I'm a Vietnam vet, 68 through 71, and I did time in both Vietnam and in other places that they still won't admit to today that we were there, okay? A lot of the guys over there, as you say, went native or whatever, but there's a hell of a big amount of guys that are listed as MIA that did that. I mean, they're over there. God willing, they're still over there, but they just got out from the sit rep that they were in. And, this guy is, God willing, I mean, I'm 61 years old, and I'm just now making terms with it, okay? But there's just my best, warmest regards to the family and to all the other guys out there. But you being a documentary sort of guy,
yeah,
you might want to look into probably 500 or 600 of these folks were in Laos, Thailand, the Golden Triangle, so to speak, working for a civilian agency, running some illicit things out of Vietnam, okay? Vietnam went on for 10 years. A lot of boys made a lot of money. A lot of us got burned out. But anyway, I said my piece. I hope they find him, but there's a lot of cats over there that are hopefully doing really well and, at peace with themselves, maybe. God bless you, people, and again, it's a great show.
Thanks for your call, Thomas. Do you want to respond to that, Henry?
Pardon?
Did you want to respond to that?
Well, one thing it reminded me of, when the film premiered in Washington, D.C. at the Silver Dogs Film Festival last summer, Mary Nolan got on her first airplane trip. She left Texas for the first time and came to the premiere, and Danny Glover, our executive producer, was there. And one of the things we did with Mary was take her to Mai Linh's famous Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., which is the beautiful wall of names of those killed and missing in Vietnam. And we were there, and it's always a very moving experience to go there. And Mary Nolan and her brother-in-law, Michael, asked the guard if McKinley Nolan's name was on the wall. And he looked into his computer, and he couldn't find the name. And then I think Michael said, well, would he be listed if he was a defector? And he said, no, defectors are not listed. And so, even after the film was finished and the journey was finished and the film premiered, I mean, Mary and Michael were devastated. Mary was like, why? He fought in the war. He went there and put his life on the line for the country. He deserves to be on this wall as well. And Thomas, the caller who just called in, sort of brought that emotion to the forefront for me.
What sort of reputation does McKinley Nolan have in the sort of POW MIA advocacy community?
Mixed. Vietnam is, what should I say? I mean, Vietnam is one of the greatest divides in our country's history since the Civil War. So the opinions about McKinley Nolan are going to be just as divided.
It really is remarkable when you get to sort of the heart of this film and you realize that the family is left with this great question, what does it mean if McKinley Nolan was a traitor? And their response to that is so much more complicated. It's almost like something they have to set aside in order to process their personal emotions about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I saw many transformations in the family, but one of the biggest ones was that when I first met them, they were battling. There was this battle between shame and defending their lost brother, husband, father. I think that this journey and was also an education in the incredible injustices that were going on during this time and during this war, and the realization of that, so that it became less about shame and more about Mary Nolan showing up at the Vietnam War Memorial and saying, why isn't my husband's name on this memorial? I mean, that's the transformation right there from A to B in the three-year period from the first day I met them to the premiere of the film.
And from the beginning, she was aware that there had been stories for a long time that McKinley Nolan may have taken another wife.
Yes. There's a beautiful scene in the film about that. I don't know if you have it.
We don't have any other clips.
I can describe it.
Yeah, describe it for us, please.
It was right after I said, you know, you've been married to this guy for 40 years. I think it was the next day we heard from Dan that he might have had another wife, and he might have had two children with that wife that he named Roger and Mary, his wife in Texas name and his son in Texas name. So I sort of asked her if she had heard about that, and she said, "Yes, I've heard." She said, but she looked up at me and she just said, "But I'm human, and he's human." And I still love him, and I know he still loves me. So,
I think that scene in particular makes you so hungry to be able to sit down with McKinley Nolan and find out what it was about him that caused people to adore him to this degree.
Yeah, it's interesting that you pick up on that. He was very charismatic. The early scenes of the movie, there's this sort of all the people of Brown's Tavern, which is the little village in Washington on the Brazos where McKinley grew up, all of those people who stayed. So there's an interesting kind of divide in this story. The people who left and went to war or went out of Washington on the Brazos, who left that county, seemed to be kind of tortured, and the people who stayed home seemed to be at peace. And so all of the friends and family paint this beautiful picture of McKinley before he left. You know, a guy who was constantly making people laugh. He was wrestling bears. He was a great baseball player. He was like this amazing, charismatic guy.
Did you contact any of the people who had served with him in the Army?
Pardon?
Did you happen to contact any of the people who served with McKinley Nolan while he was with the U.S. Army?
You know, we spent months trying to track down people that were in his infantry and could not find anyone who was still alive who knew McKinley, which I thought was really odd. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that our filmmaking just added to the mystery. You know, that our quest in the film was just deepening the mystery around him. Like, that, you know, I know that my production company and offices and journalists, Richard Lynette and Dan and the Nolans, we were all putting an all points bulletin out for people with the military on the internet everywhere to find someone who actually knew McKinley, and we could not find one. So it just contributes to this idea that he's a ghost.
And it's hard to know what may or may not have gone wrong for him.
Yeah.
How did Richard Lynette get tied into this story? Because he was following it long before Dan Smith thought he saw McKinley Nolan in Vietnam.
Yeah, he was. I think he wrote a book about a mutiny that occurred on a ship, and about another mutiny that had occurred where some soldiers hijacked a ship, and he kept hearing this. I mean, you would have to ask Richard, but he kept hearing this name, McKinley Nolan. He was sort of like this legendary Bigfoot character that everybody was talking about was still around, but nobody really knew who he was. And so I believe that led him to further research, to go down and meet the Nolans. And he started in 1998.
So the violence with the Khmer Rouge that may have been the end of McKinley Nolan's life happened in the late 70s, like 1977.
Right? 77.
Okay.
Which was the peak year for the killings in this particular region.
So talk about why Dan Smith was so convinced that it was Nolan that he saw.
Very interesting question. Well, one of the things that I want to say is that I want the viewer to draw their own conclusions on this. And it was the film was very carefully and respectfully crafted to portray the nuance and ambiguity of where Dan Smith might be coming from. So I don't want to pass judgment mm-hmm. on this and on his character. I have my own personal opinions, but I'm not sure if they're right. I believe that he saw a black man in Tainan in the year 2007. I'm not sure if he had heard the name McKinley Nolan before that and projected it onto this person. I'm not sure if he genuinely did encounter him. It's very unlikely in Vietnam that a black man could be, you know, a man who would stand out as an African American mm-hmm. Could be living off. There is no off the grid in that part of Vietnam. It's just too controlled by the government. I mean, even local people, even Vietnamese who travel between province and prefecture have to register with the police when they arrive. So it's a very closely monitored culture. So it's very unlikely that McKinley could be living off the grid there. So I'm sorry, but, you know, I just don't know. But I do think that Dan brought the family a kind of peace. Without even knowing it, he brought them a kind of truth and got them closer to closure for whatever reason he did, you know, no matter what he saw in Tainan in 2007.
Filmmaker Henry Cora is my guest. His new documentary is called The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan. It's screening this week as part of the Dallas International Film Festival. You can learn more about Henry Cora at corafilms.com. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. Call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Henry Cora. His documentary, The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan, screens this week as part of the Dallas International Film Festival. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Henry, do you think that Dan Smith found a measure of peace by undertaking this journey?
Yes, I do. He told me that he just wanted to try to bring peace to someone else. And in the end, when the Nolans found out what happened to McKinley, Dan said told me that his work was done. I mean, the last image you see of him in the film is him sort of walking off on his own. Mm-hmm. And he said that he realized that he had this lifelong obsession with killing this man during the war in Vietnam was winding down, and that he needed to get back to his family. And in my communications with Dan since then, he has not returned to Vietnam. He used to come to Vietnam two or three times a year, you know, revisiting the battlefields of his youth in a kind of quest for atonement. And from what I hear, he's been his health has not been good, but he's been repairing and mending and focusing on his family, which he felt he had neglected for many years.
I have to say, the scenes in the film where you see Americans, including one American soldier and former VC soldiers, sitting down and talking and being somewhat friendly and drinking tea together. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a viewer, they're sort of quietly electrifying. I wonder how they resonate still with you as the filmmaker who was physically present watching this take place.
Yeah. It just made me realize that war is the enemy. You know, war is the enemy, and everybody, they had much more in common. This idea of the good guys and the bad guys, or right or wrong, or VC versus American, was so irrelevant in that room, or the Khmer Rouge. It was like, hello, we're humans, and this is a crazy, barbaric, painful act that we humans do called war, and it does not go away. There was the look in their eye, you know, 40, 50 years later, they all had that look in their eye that this is not going to go away, and it's not going to go away for generations. My family, personally, I was, my grandparents were taken prisoner of war by the Japanese in Hong Kong during World War II. And I can tell you that three generations, four generations later, without getting too into it, because it's a little off topic, but it's certainly one of the motivations for me wanting to be with the Nolans and to help the Nolans. I can tell you the repercussions of that trauma still reverberate in our family. So, you know, wars don't end. They echo on and on and on. They haunt people forever.
Do you see in modern-day Vietnam a sort of generation gap between people who were formed during the worst years of this conflict, and then people who've been born after into this much more prosperous, much more modern country? Do they understand one another?
You know, I know the question that you're asking me right now, and I'm going to have a really hard time answering it, because we were so controlled when we were in Vietnam with who we could meet and who we could talk to and how we could talk to them, that I don't feel, unlike Cambodia, where we were given total freedom to sit with people and to relate with them for days at a time, and to really marinate and kind of understand each other through the subtle gestures and the looks in each other's eyes. We weren't allowed to do that in Vietnam. We were monitored every minute. We had minders. They were called minders. And everything was very orchestrated. So it was kind of a relief to cross the border into Cambodia, where everything seemed so free, and you really could get to know people. And even Quang, McKinley's stepson, once he crossed the border into Cambodia, is when he started sharing stories of his regret at the soldiers he had killed who were only trying to get home to their families.
Hmm.
So, sorry about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's a really moving scene as well, when he sort of reflects on that. And I guess I wasn't fully aware that happened in Cambodia, but it's very moving, because it's like this sense, and you don't get the sense that it came upon him suddenly, but he's understood for some time that they were all not so different from one another.
Right. You know, and Michael Nolan kept looking out the window and talking about how the countryside in Cambodia looked like the countryside in Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said, I've got cows like that. And I mean, there was this amazing, you know, it's something that you've really called to my attention, which I love when people bring new things to me from seeing the film, is that there was a desire for commonality among all of these foreign people, strange people who had never met each other before and who had these traumatic histories with each other. So I like what you are receiving from the movie.
What did you do? I know you worked with some translators. How awkward was that? How easy was that to overcome, the fact that there wasn't always a common language?
You know, everybody worries about that, but I've been making films. I made a film about the artist Christo in Japan. I spent 3 years in Japan. I've made films all in Africa, all over the world, in foreign languages. And everybody says, how are you going to connect with the people? Well, again, you have an amazingly intelligent and skilled simultaneous translator who goes well beyond just translating the words, but sort of the nuances of the conversations. You have to find these amazing people. They're just they're amazing people. And so then it's that combined, so that the communication, you want to be able to start talking to the person, have the person who's speaking the foreign language look you in the eyes when they talk to you. Mm-hmm. And that happens after a few days with a really good translator. And the second thing is that you really, you log in the time with these people. I keep saying that over and over. It's like, it's an immersive thing. So that after many, many days together, there's a kind of familiarity.
So you have all of this. You come home with, am I right, that it was 77 hours of material?
No. We shot 350 hours.
350 hours, okay. And it's a 77-minute film. Perhaps that's it. Okay. So how, where do you begin? There must be things that you loved but you finally realized didn't quite fit into the sort of arc of what you had created. How do you start to make those choices?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not a reductive process. I mean, basically, films, the kind of, all films are written. They're just written at different times. And in the way that we make movies, I would say the films are kind of, in a sense, written four or five different times. There's the first, when the journalist first told me about the story, this sort of image comes into my head, and I'm like, wow, that could be an amazing film. And in a sense, that's the first time it's written. You go down and you meet the family, and you start to travel with them over a year or 2 years. And the story is constantly unfolding and defining and redefining itself. You come back with all of your footage and you screen it, every single moment of it. You spend 6 to 8 weeks screening and very carefully selecting the material. And it's not just pulling out the best stuff. It's about like really allowing the footage to speak to you and sort of really understanding what you really got. And then it starts to be, that's the third time or fourth time it's rewritten. And then you actually go in and you start structuring, finding the structure, finding the story, and basically writing the film with the footage itself. Hmm. And then you go through many versions of that until you get it right. And, you know, not only is that the way the film is written, but it's how you find out what the film is about.
And do you think the final time the film was written is actually when you screen the completed piece with an audience there?
Yes, absolutely. The circle is not complete until everybody has gone through the same kind of struggle. And so the subjects have their struggle, the filmmaker has their struggle, and then it's not complete until the audience goes through that struggle.
Is it different in different cities and different places among different age groups when you screen it?
Interesting thing about this movie is it has a very mesmerizing kind of ambient quality to it. It's almost like it starts off as a mystery, but the language of the film has a very ambient internal quality to it. You sort of get inside the character's head. The line between the past and the present is blurred with archival footage, and you sort of shift between the past and present and inside and outside of people's heads in a kind of seamless, almost liquid way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's across the board, like an audience in Washington, D.C., a world premiere with Danny Glover at Silver Docks, a group of high school students in Montana. I mean, I've probably screened the film many, many, many dozens of times all over the United States in the last 6 months. And to a fault, the audiences are mesmerized. You can hear a pin drop during the whole movie, and they get up, and it's an open-ended film. It's left. There's a big part of it that's left to the viewer. And people are very kind of quiet and introspective, and small conversations will ensue. And we found that not having Q&As after the film is more effective than just letting little groups of people gather around us out in the lobby afterwards. And it's been very consistently mesmerizing.
Well, I was struck by the fact that there are a couple of occasions throughout the film where things are left unsaid very deliberately, like you'll flash to a variety of people sort of reacting with their faces alone. And I wonder if you had sound bites and then decided it was more powerful to sort of leave those thoughts internal.
No, I mean, that was, the language of the film was something that we worked on very hard, you know, with the editors and experimented with and pushed and pulled in many different directions. But ultimately, there's a subtle kind of meditative quality that we wanted to maintain in the movie. So there is that space. There's always that space and allowing the image rather than exposition to carry you.
Having spoken to a number of independent documentary filmmakers, I know that funding is always a challenge. Is it easier? Is it more difficult to come in with something like this before you know what the ending is going to be and convince people to get on board and give you the money you need to make the film?
Documentary filmmaking is, there's so much money in it. You know, you'll become a millionaire. I promise you. It's very lucrative business. No. The thing is that, you know, I think Oprah Winfrey interviewed Cormac McCarthy and asked him about, did he know the ends of his novel, you know, how his novels were going to turn out? And he went, no, I would never want that. Well, you know, as you can tell from this conversation, the same is true with us. We don't want to, I don't want to know the end of the story. I want to find out what the story's about by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but when you pitch to places like HBO, Showtime, potential investors, that's a really difficult switch. You can't just walk in there and go, well, I got these great characters and this guy who's kind of a ghost, and I have no idea how it's going to turn out.
So. Yeah, I just want to sort of follow it to its conclusion.
But
yeah.
I just want to tell you guys a little secret. That's the truth, and that's how it works. You really don't know. And what an investor or a network is investing in is the filmmaker's past work and in the faith in knowing that when you have great characters and great storytelling and great filmmaking, that great films always happen.
So is that where the gift of documentary filmmakers lies, in knowing when you have a story worth telling?
For me, it's key. And it's not just, like, do I have a great story, but does that bell go off in my head, and am I like merged
mm-hmm.
with this subject? It's an emotional thing as much as it is an artistic thing.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm in California right now, and I'm on the quote unquote set of a film that's untitled right now, but it's called The Reggie Project.
Mm-hmm.
And again, yet again, it's the story of I'm basically very much embedded with a young woman, 18-year-old woman, who is battling stage 4 cancer.
I hate to have to cut you off right there. We're running out of time, but we'll look forward to that film when it's complete.
Yeah.
The new documentary by Henry Cora is The Disappearance of McKinley Nolan. Henry, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.